My guess is now, especially if it's a young person heading off to school tomorrow, we don't want to keep them up any later. Back to you, John.
Okay, yeah, this youngster follows the space report. He listens to it on the amateur TV, and he's very interested in this. But he had a question. He'd like to know if you have any information or if you know, what is the oldest spacecraft that is lurking about up there in orbit or wherever in space that hasn't returned yet or destroyed itself? What is the oldest craft still up there? It doesn't have to be working or not. He just wants to know what the oldest relic is. Back to you, Paul. KC2WGB.
There's been so many that have gone up that are still functioning. Of course, we always talk about Voyager back in 77, they sent up Voyager 1 and 2. Actually, they sent up Voyager 2 and then 1, but in that order. So that's still functioning, still sending information back. But there's other ones. You know, there's, we have another one called WIND that was launched in 1994. They expected the thing, well, maybe it'll last a couple of years, and they sent it out to Lagrange Point number 1. And look, that, you know, L1 is located about a million miles between us and the sun, and it's just sitting there gravitationally being pulled equally by the sun and Earth, and it just goes completely around the sun. It always stares at the sun and has an antenna pointing back toward Earth, sending us information. Any of the spacecraft that are out there do that. And WIND that was sent out, launched in 1994, still functioning. In fact, just on the Deep Space Network, let me drop it.
Yeah, hold on a minute here, Paul. Stand by. The Russians put up the very first spacecraft in 1957, I think it was. But by the time we hit 1960 or so, a number of relatively high-altitude spacecraft were launched. I'll bet some of them haven't come back. He's not asking the one with the greatest distance. He's asking the one with the greatest number of years of service. I'll bet you a couple of those spacecraft went into fairly high orbit in the early 60s. Might still be there, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, yeah, especially the ones in the high orbit. There's a glove floating around from one of the Gemini missions. They say never came back because it was in such a high orbit. But with this thousands of satellites functioning and non-functioning still going around Earth, probably 10,000 of them. You know, I know there's about 1,000 functional ones. So which ones were sent up? Like we, you know, we could go through a list of the earlier ones. You know, from Russia with. With all the Vostok missions, but you know, nothing there is functioning. We have Explorer 1 we sent up, and they say that's still orbiting. Because that went up to check out the Van Allen belts. That was launched on a Jupiter C rocket, and they say that's still going around, but not functioning. In fact, that was a battery operated one. So I'm not sure what, you know, what else we can talk about. You know, there's so many spacecraft that are not only in orbit, but we have spacecraft in orbit around Mars that is actually not functioning as well. The original Viking missions, you know, that we sent landers, well, they had orbiters, and they're still going around. They never deorbited Mars. They're just going around and around, not functioning. Back eject.
So if Van Allen, if the Van Allen belt measurer, Explorer, which I think was, I'm going to make a rough guess, 1959. If Explorer for Van Allen belt investigation of 1959, roughly, is still in orbit, it's coming close to one of the very oldest ones that's still there. The Russian beep 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 satellite in 1957, we know that one's come back. But Vanguard was launched a little bit higher, still there. Might be since 1959, rough guess, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Dick, you you know that Sputnik has returned, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I know that Sputnik came back. But the Van Allen belt measuring American spacecraft, Paul is saying, is still there. That may be one of the very oldest ones. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I believe it is. It's, you know, you get up to these 600-mile altitudes. I think they thought it was going to come back by now. You know, what happens is the atmosphere constantly gets heated by the sun. And I don't think the atmosphere expanded as much as, you know, when it gets heated, the atmosphere expands. And you still get some molecules that get up there pretty high. And that tends to slow things down. And they predicted, originally they predicted it would have come back by now. But they found out over time the atmosphere didn't expand as much as they thought at that time. So it still goes around and around. The Explorer mission, that was a rocket about, well, a satellite anyway, about, it looked like about four or 5 feet long. I remember Von Braun in pictures holding it up with a couple of the other guys. And when it was launched, it would spin. They had a spinning mechanism on top of the rocket. Before it ever took off, you can actually see it spinning if you look at the old tapes. And so it was spin stabilized. So it's still up there, probably still spinning, going around and around. Back to you, Dick.
That's probably old enough for the time being, Paul. Go right ahead.
Okay, Dick, and I'm getting noise in my speaker. I don't know why I'm going to transmit. That's odd. Let me lower that. Okay, yeah, you asked about Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 anyway. That was 134 AU, 134 times the distance between the Earth and Sun. And then Voyager 2 is, it just broke the 110 number probably about a month or so ago. So off they go. New Horizons, you know, that's out probably around 41, I think, now, AU. That just passed Pluto last year, and then that was Pluto's furthest distance, is around 39 AU. And New Horizon is now halfway through its transmission of data back to Earth. So that'll go on for another probably 8 months or so. We drop it. With that, they're looking for the mission to be extended. They need to get the funding, but my guess is they'll probably get it. And they want to visit Kuiper object, MU69, I think it's called. About 30 miles in diameter. And they do want to go past that very closely, take pictures, and they'll be doing the same thing that they did with Pluto. They'll load up the memory as they go by and take many, many months, maybe a year, to retransmit the information back to Earth. That'll probably happen in 2019 for that part of the mission. They plan on looking at some of the other, similar planets to Pluto. What would you call them? Dwarf planets. One called, I pronounce it Makemake because that's the way it's pronounced. Indian pronunciation of that. A couple of the other ones, I think Eris is on the list. They want to just take measurements. They're not going to get close enough for pictures, but they might be able to take some scientific information off of those dwarf planets. So that mission's not over. As far as the regular report for tonight, I was just going to talk about a rocket that was supposed to go up from French Guiana, but that was delayed two times in a row. And then tonight, I was supposed to go over. I was going to watch it. Let me drop it. Okay. wound up with a technical failure. Don't know what it is yet. And now they're going to delay that launch to Friday. And that has three different types of satellites on board. All for the European Space Agency. But it's interesting, it's launched on a Soyuz rocket, and everybody thinks, it's a Soyuz rocket, it's a Russian thing. It's not the European Space Agency. It's bought some of these Soyuz rockets, and then they work on them, they change some things, and it becomes theirs, and they launched them from French Guiana. And that's very close to the equator, talking about the air. The help from that 1,000-mile push from the equator, it does help for rockets to be launched near the equator. So that'll probably go up Friday, and that's always an interesting spaceport because they launched three different types of rockets there now. They launched the Soyuz, that's the medium lift type of rocket you would consider as that, and then they have the Ariane 5, that's the big one, and that will be the rocket that will be launching James Webb. We have a contract with the European Space Agency to launch that from French Guiana with their heavy lift vehicle, and they have a light lift vehicle too that they've been running some science science types of flights from the same spaceport, and that's called Vega, built in Italy. So there's three different types of rockets. Everybody likes to have three different versions of rockets, at least, a light, medium, and a heavy version to accommodate all the different possible satellites. This one here that's going to be launched on Friday is a polar mission. So, but it's going to put the three different satellites at different altitudes. So it's going to take about a half dozen orbits to complete its mission. Let me drop it. So, outside of that, I don't have really that much this week. I do want to mention China, of course. They were still pushing. They just sent up a rocket. Lasted about 2 weeks, a satellite in space. They brought it back. It has a heat shield. But they do science experiments with nobody on board, and they've done this a couple of times. And they landed successfully in the Gobi Desert. It gives them plenty of practice for their manned missions as well. And Russia's got a launch coming up this middle of this week. From there, the new spaceport. There's more spaceports around the world than you can count. And they just built a new one. It took them billions of dollars, probably 15 years to build. And they'll be launching their first Soyuz science mission from Voskhodsny out in eastern Russia, like 4,000 or 5,000 miles away from Moscow. That's pretty much it, Dick. Any questions, comments? I'll turn it back to you. This is WS2M.
Okay, let's see if we have any questions from the listening audience during the space report. Give us your call letters right now if you want to ask Paul anything about any of these spacecraft, what NASA and the European Space Agency and the Japanese Space Agency and the Chinese Space Agency, what they're all doing. And I think I remember reading somewhere, I think it was from you last week, telling us that China, I think, has a plan to land a spacecraft on the moon in the near future. Let's first find out if we have anyone that's going to have any further questions or comments for Paul. Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNav. Yeah, I think you told us last week, Paul, that I think it's China. I don't think it's Japan, that has launched a plan to put a spacecraft, is it on Mars or the Moon or both? Maybe it's Mars. So I think China has got on their menu a spacecraft to land on one of those celestial bodies in the troop hole, WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, Mars is in the distant future for them. They do have plans on doing that as well, but right now the immediate flights that they have planned is the Chang 5 mission, which is going to go to the moon. They want to land on the dark side of the moon. That's the goal, but to do it, they'd like to put a satellite around orbit the moon to try to get some kind of communication on the other side of the moon. You need a repeater in the sky. They plan on doing that first and then landing a craft on the moon. Nobody's landed anything or even tried to land anything on the opposite side of the moon. I hate to call it the dark side, but that's what I always call it, but the opposite side of the moon. So we'll see about that. They have plenty of space plans, like this thing that just came back. The Tianjin 10 is a standard flight for them. They send it up, does fine missions robotically, and then they bring it back. And, but their manned missions are going to be continuing this year. First with the launch of their second operational space station. Tiangong 2, and eventually there'll be a 3. And with that, they'll send up a crew of 3. They'll dock with it, and they'll try to have some kind of continuous support up there. They don't plan on being up there, you know, year in, year out, like we do with the International Space Station. But they plan on going up for, you know, a couple of months at a time, and then bring the spacecraft back, and then send another one up. You know, maybe leave it in orbit without, you know, unmanned for a while. Probably similar to what we did with Skylab. But at least this one will have two docking ports where the crew will be up there, and if they need some supplies, they have developed similar spacecraft to the Progress. In fact, it looks like the Progress. And they'll dock with the Tiangong space station, and then they'll have supplies. And their long-term goal is probably about 4 or 5 years out, is to send up another space station, Tiangong 3, and that will have modular construction. You might have 3, 4, 5 of these module pieces that they'll put together, similar to what we did with the ISS. Big plans for China, and eventually Mars. I know they have a Mars plan too. I saw some kind of information on that as well back either.
Very fine, Paul. On a slightly different subject, I don't know how I got on that distribution list, but this digest is called Qura, Q-U-O-R-A. And once every day or two, they send me a list of questions with answers, sometimes answered, and they're quasi-scientific. Okay, one of the latest questions somebody asked was, if you get stranded on the moon and you have an infinite supply of oxygen, water, and food, and the implication is you're in a spacesuit, but they didn't get into those details. So, as far as your consumables are concerned, you get an infinite supply, but you're stranded on the moon and nobody knows you're there, and you don't have a radio. How would you let them know? And the answer that was given, let me drop it, is that it's going to take you a year to do it. But you take your shovel, and in the dirt of the moon, you start digging down to the dirt. It's got a dark surface with a lighter surface in between. And so as you scrape the surface of the moon, you can draw letters on the moon. So if you draw letters that are big enough, you can spell out H-E-L-P. And they recommend that you spell out H-L-E-P. In other words, intentionally misspell it so they know it was you and me who did it. And if you spend about a year cutting these letters into the surface of the moon, the portion supply of food, water, and air. Sounds good. No air near good enough. Let me drop. No way to describe what the habitat was and why you're out there with the shovel scraping these letters into the surface of the moon. Hopefully you're in a spacesuit. But you put a human being in a spacesuit for more than about 6 hours. Bear in mind, the person inside that spacesuit is wearing a very large diaper. I don't think I have to go much deeper into that. You're eventually going to get diaper rash. And you don't want to be there more than 6, 7, or 8 hours. And there's a whole lot of refurbishment of the spacesuit required before you can climb back into it again and use it again. You've got to have a habitat. So they're forgetting some extremely minor details, like the surface of the moon, because the moon goes around the Earth once every 28 days. So any particular portion of the moon, from your point of view, it's got a 28-day period. In other words, you've got sunlight for 14 days and darkness for 14 days. As such, no matter where you stand on the moon, near the equator, we'll say, in the long daylight of 14 days, it goes up to numbers like 150 degrees centigrade. At nighttime, it goes down to numbers like minus 150 degrees centigrade. The average temperature might be plus 10 degrees centigrade. Very nice average temperature. But those extremes once every 28 days are really fierce. It's a little bit similar to if you use your machine gun in a library, the average amount of sound is not very great, but the peak energy is huge. Let me drop. On the moon, the average temperature is a nice number, but you've got to be in a habitat that is, let me pick a number, 50 meters below the surface, where the temperature is a little bit more steady. On the surface, I don't think there's air conditioning in the world that can keep you alive at 150 degrees centigrade. Yeah, there's a heating element that can keep you alive at minus 150 degrees centigrade, but that much air conditioning, I doubt it. We completely forget about it, and many of the astronauts forget about it too. Even the astronauts that have been there. I've read some quotes by Buzz Aldrin, for instance, where he'd like to build a habitat on the surface of the moon. He was there, walking around on the moon, so he wants to go back and stay for a while. He completely forgets about the fact that the guys in the back room at NASA, let me drop, they did a very careful calculation as to where on the moon they land them, at what portion of the lunar cycle did they land them there. Each one of those lunar landings of Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17 were done on a spot on the moon as very close to sunrise or sunset, nowhere near high noon at 150 positive centigrade, nowhere near them at nighttime at minus 150 degrees centigrade. They were very carefully located, and they were there for a couple of days during that twilight, and the day is 14 days long. You got to be very careful where you go and when you go to the moon. So without some kind of a habitat that's way below the surface, where the temperature's a little bit more constant, and how in the world do you establish that habitat? I mean, to dig this habitat hole in the ground, you know, the equivalent of a subway station, so to speak, you're going to be there for a good number of days. Well, you don't have any period of time where the temperature is a nice number for that number of days to dig the habitat. So you'd have to make a whole lot of trips, short trips there, and dig a little bit each of the time, each on each trip. To make a permanent habitat anywhere near the equator of the moon is an extremely big endeavor that doesn't meet the common sense. You wouldn't think about it at first. In theory, there are a couple of places near the North Pole and the South Pole where you're right at the rim of where the sun just barely comes over the edge, and maybe there's liquid water there, although there are, I think they're predicting extremely cold temperatures at the poles. So dwelling on the moon more than a couple of days at any one fixed spot is a hell of a lot more difficult than first meets the eye. What have you read anything along these lines, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, very good. You made it, Dick. Shackleton Crater, I know they would like to set up a moon base there because of that exact reason, where it's mostly sunny. It really doesn't really get dark. I mean, it's going to be very cold, so they're going to have to really dig that ice out of the craters and, you know, using mining equipment and then get it to a warm place and defrost it. And then you could strip mine the moon and get, you know, strip mine the regolith, and then there's molecules of water, you know, over miles and miles of the moon. You could, you know, you get enough water to do something with, but they're hoping that there's a lot of ice down at the bottom of these craters. So, with that, they'll be happy. You could get oxygen and hydrogen for fuel. You'll be able to set up solar panels down near Shackleton Crater to supply that moon base. Let me drop it.
Yeah, hold on, Paul. We better let it drop a long time so that the 375 comes back. It just came back.
Okay, yeah, I hear that on my HT. So, yeah, you're going to have a lot of work to get that done. But, you know, the European Space Agency really would like to do that. I mean, that's... They got a guy in charge of that that's really pushing for a moon base on the south pole of the moon. That's their long-term goal, not Mars. They want to contribute to Mars. The European Space Agency right now is in the process of building the service module for the Orion spacecraft that's going to be going to Mars. So that's their contribution. So maybe one of the astronauts this way will probably guarantee somebody from ESA. My guess, you're going to have American, and you'll probably have a Russian, and maybe they'll be involved with it as well. Did you ever have a look at space.com? They had a story about the wild signal there. That it's not intelligent, and it's probably a comet. And he knows when this comet is coming back, and he's going to try to get enough money together, put up a similar type of antenna to try to duplicate that signal. I wonder if you saw that article.
Yes, I think I did see that article, Paul. And that wow signal, I'm not sure, but I think the amplitude of the signal was measured once every 10 seconds or something like that, and they came up with a letter number code for the amplitude during that period of sampling. And that antenna was, I've been at that antenna in, I think it's Miamisburg, Ohio, the Ohio Wesleyan University Radio Telescope, it was called. It's 150 feet wide, something like 75 feet high, in front of a great big chunk of concrete, with metal spread over that concrete. To build that antenna today is quite a few megabucks. That's not easy. Now, because that wow signal was as strong as it was, do you need an antenna that big is an interesting question. But I sure wish, very similar to the movie Contact, where the lady astronomer, let me drop her. She would listen to the radio signals with her earphones. To just record amplitude and not listen to it is a huge waste. That signal of the wow signal, boy, it would be nice to know, was it a hissing broadband noise? Was it modulated in some way? It sure would be nice to know what it was. And but as I see it, it had all of the characteristics of being extraterrestrial. Something at a much further than a synchronous orbit, because the way that radio telescope works, there were two separate horns side by side, and so your signal sweeps to the first horn and sweeps to the second horn a given number of minutes later, and I think that signal did sweep through both horns at exactly the right timing to represent the two responses of an object that's at a nearly infinite distance as far as an earthbound antenna is concerned. So, in theory, they could use a much smaller antenna. Any one of the large dish antennas of NASA would do. However, to talk NASA into taking one of their big dishes and dedicated to this receiving operation. So the number of hours and days required is essentially out of the question. By way of that website, you and I can see how busy those dishes are. Every one of those dishes is listening to something out there during some portion of every day. One of our spacecraft out there downloading. And I think there's a lot of downloading going on right now of the New Horizons spacecraft. It's still downloading a whole lot of fancy pictures and technical data of what it saw as it went whizzing by Mars, whizzing by Pluto. Because the downlink is only at some number of kilohertz per second. And they've got lots of gigabytes of data to download. So I think the estimation it was going to take a year and a half or 2 years after the mission to download all the data. Because as the signal gets very far away and very weak, let me drop.
Quick question.
Okay, Barry. As the signal gets far enough away and very weak, we can still listen to the data of the signal as long as the data is slow enough and your receiver is more narrow in bandwidth and you know the exact frequency. N2MB, wait for all the beeps, Barry. K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, you guys were talking about a space station on the moon. You said that the heat from the sun tents. Couldn't they make a canopy with holes in it, adjustable holes, that where they could regulate the amount of heat that would reach below the canopy?
Yeah, you want to build, if I understand correctly, Barry, you want to build a radome, a highly reflective object that protects the astronauts on the inside during the 14 days of high noon on the moon, where it normally goes to 150 degrees centigrade. Could you build a canopy to reflect all that sunlight? I think you could. You've got another problem now. All the soil around you in all directions is getting hot and it's radiating heat toward you. Could you reflect enough of that? I think you could, but it's not simple. But that's an interesting approach, Barry. That's one I've never heard of. You build a canopy big enough that's reflective enough, and it's got a whole bunch of individual panels that you can tilt so that you collect heat as it starts getting cold. You've got enough solar cells, you've charged up your battery, so for the 14 days of night, when it goes down to minus 150, you can keep yourself warm. And you're reflective enough at high noon on the moon for 14 days so that you can keep yourself from cooking at 150. I think it's possible, but boy, when you land there and you've got to put up this radome fast enough before the sun gets to high noon. And if you don't make it, boy, you're in a heap of trouble. But that's a possible approach, Barry. That's a goodie. How big do you think that radome would have to be, and how would you inflate it in a hurry, Barry? I guess you would inflate it with some kind of a gas. N2 moon bomb? With a real loony idea. K2RIW. Go ahead, Barry.
I don't know. If there isn't a lot of gravity, so things don't weigh much. You might be able to open it up like a big umbrella. Possibly. You know, I got to think about that. But there are other angles to this. But right now I'm in front of my house and I got to go inside. But I just thought I would bring that up. I think, as I was thinking of it, you know, give it a lot more thought. I think you could develop it into a bar. Oh, by the way, you don't have people do it. It's an automatic thing. It goes up there and it plays itself, and then you send the people.
And that's what I was just trying to say, but I doubled with Barry.
So it sounds like it's possible to build a habitat that can tolerate the high noon crazy temperatures on the moon, and later on you build them. Send up the guys with their excavating equipment, and they start digging a habitat. Let me pick a number, you know, 10, 30, 60 meters below the soil, where the temperature is much more constant. And that way you've got more survivability of meteorite temperature or whatever. And you wouldn't need a great big heater in the wind, and at nighttime, and a great big sunshade in the daytime, if you're deep enough down where the temperature is constant.
I'm a dick.
Go ahead, John. Wait for the beeps.
Yes, Dick. You know, it's very interesting. I have three gentlemen. Two of them come from Stanford. They come once a year in June and July, and we spend a day here having some nice conversations. The other gentleman is a professor in Ohio or Kentucky. I don't remember the school he's with, but we spoke about this last year, and they're working on what they consider a tunnel boring machine that'll be probably sent to the moon. It'll put in pieces, whatever they have to do, assembled, and then they could just leave it there and let it do its job and maybe visit it once every 6 months or whatever they have to do. They don't have to stay there and babysit it. But that's what they're thinking about, to get a habitat that's going to be deep enough. I just thought that you might be interested in that. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we've got to wait until the machine resets out east. It just came back. Now, a teleboarding machine, that's the word you used. What is this machine that's doing the boring in the habitat below the surface? Run that by again, John, go ahead.
A tunnel boring machine, like they use for the Holland Tunnel or any tunnel that they'd like to build today, or the water tunnel. A large boring machine. Of course, not as big as those, but something similar. And that's what they're trying to work out. It's, you know, just a theory, but it might pay.
Yeah, you and I have seen a couple of PBS specials, Channel 25 specials, where they've shown you the use of that boring machine under the city of New York City in order to bore a tunnel. And boy, that machine looks like it's a zillion pounds, even a small version of that, to ship that to the moon, where each pound of something you put into orbit costs you $5,000, and send something from orbit around the Earth to the moon is another 10-to-1 degree of difficulty. To move a machine like that to the moon, wow. That might take 30 space shuttle launches to take that machine in pieces and do that, John, if you know what I mean. Back to you, John.
Oh, yeah, the weight is significant, but they said there are many elements on the device that could be reformed with carbon fiber and things like that, which have similar strength and would be able to do the job. They can probably, they know they could cut it in half, the weight. Of course, the cutting tips are still going to be a problem. They are heavy, but I don't know how many trips it would take, but that's what they're thinking. It would operate a lot slower, so it doesn't have to have the same work capabilities, because they're not in a big hurry, and they would just let it do its job, all computer operated. The only thing is the mucking evidence of it, of the taking out the scrap material, is usually on a conveyor system that's adjustable, so that has to be automated. You know, things like that. There'll be problems, of course, but it's just one thing they're working on, and it can cut pretty quickly.
When that tunnel boring machine is doing its tunneling under the city of New York, where does the power come from? I'm guessing it's a huge diesel engine. And to run that huge diesel engine in the vacuum of the moon, that's an interesting endeavor, John. Over to you, John.
I've had a lot of rumors.
Dick, I believe it's electrically operated. I don't think it's any type of reciprocating engine.
Okay, so maybe they're using a zillion kilowatts of Con Ed power to run that machine. You ain't got that on the moon. So the energy to run the machine on the moon, in the vacuum, boy, that means if you do it with some kind of a reciprocal internal combustion engine, you've got to supply all the oxygen and fuel to run that. Boy, this is a difficult process. I think a small steam shovel, yeah, that's not going to do it either. This is a toughie. Did somebody have a suggestion as to how to solve the energy problem of running the machine on the moon?
I was just suggesting solar power and small machines, a bunch of small machines that run on solar power.
Okay, a bunch of small machines running on solar power. Not bad.
Nanobots.
Barry, what radio are you using? Your audio is very narrow. Is that a Balfong?
Oh, no, it's actually it's an ICOM. But everybody tells me they don't have enough audio. It's been that way since I got it. Anyway, I got to go inside, so I will listen to you from the other end at 2MB.
Roger, Barry. You got to shout into that mic. Let me let it drop. So, Paul, you were also saying that one of the space agencies is proposing to build a lunar base near one of the poles. Who's proposing to do that? How soon are they going to do it? And what's their motive for doing that? Is that going to be a permanent manned station? Is it also going to be investigating the amount of local water that's available in those craters that are near the poles? Hope you both. WS2N, KQRIW.
Well, that's the European Space Agency's long-term goals. European Space Agency is a group of about 20 different countries. So, primarily Germany and France, and, England has really cut back on supporting it. But, the head of it now, I forget his name, he's pushing for that. But right now they don't have any way to even send people in space. They're working on that problem too. They believe they could use the Ariane 5 rocket, and they might make a deal eventually with Sierra Nevada Corporation. They're the ones that are building Dream Chaser to eventually launch Dream Chaser from South America, from Kourou, French Guiana. So it's a cargo vehicle, and eventually develop into a manned spacecraft. But they got a long way to go. This long-term planning, everybody has to have a long-term goal. Theirs is the moon, the United States is Mars. Now let me drop it. So that's pretty much it. Russia is planning on continuing with space station activities. They have long-term goals of going back to the moon as well, but it got a little expensive, so they're going to cut back. Their ideas haven't really changed. They plan on doing basically the same thing as the European Space Agency over time, but we're looking at probably, 10, 15, 20 years down the road.
Yeah, in the middle of my last couple of exchanges, the Eastern link went down again. I guess periodically we've got to wait and let everything drop to make sure that thing comes back. So that's an interesting statement you just made, Paul. European Space Agency is favoring the moon, and the United States is favoring Mars for a long-range project. The moon makes some sense. Mars, as you've heard me say so often, I don't think you get anywhere near enough return on the huge investment of risk of life and risk of money required to go to Mars. It's nice to plan and build hardware capable, but I don't think we should do it. So, European Space Agency, lunar base, do they give a rough estimate as to how many years from now they might be doing it, Paul, WS2N? Wait till the machine is thoroughly dropped, KQRIW.
No, I didn't see a long-term plan. I saw some kind of, they have pictures of their would-be base that they would put on the moon, It's like half-slated things to me that are connected together. It looks like a tap built into the moon. Actually, Arthur C. Clarke had it right with 2001 Space Odyssey. If you ever saw that movie, everything was under the moon. That base, it was called Clavius. Their base was under the moon. They had it right. When the spacecraft came in from, to land at their base, this whole thing would open up on the surface of the moon, and it would land, and then they'd have hydraulic lifts bringing it, inside the moon, and all the offices and buildings, people, the living quarters, everything was underneath. I think that would be the right way to go for a future base. Like John said, spot drilling. I just saw a special on. I'm going to time out. I just saw a special on drilling for tunnels in Switzerland. They went right through the mountains, longest one anywhere. I think they said it was 37 miles long. And one had, you know, they had a drill from one side, and the other people had a drill from the other side, and they had to meet exactly in the middle. They couldn't be off more than 4 centimeters or something like that. And it worked. It took them like 20 some odd years to do this drilling. But the drill was 1,500 feet long. It was the world's biggest one. So, you know, it was like 4 or 5 times the size of a football field. it was a humongous thing. It had to be brought in and assembled on location, you know. They put two of them in, you know, one for one end of the mountain, one for the other end. You know, you couldn't bring that thing to the moon. Although, you know, the moon is 1/6 the gravity. I guess everything could be 1/6 less. So, you know, you go from hundreds of millions of pounds. Just to put the space station up there, that was 1 million pounds, and that was about the equivalent of 40 flights of shuttles and Russian flights to do that. That was only in, you know, low Earth orbit. I mean, even if Elon Musk gets his rocket down to, he wants to eventually make it a 1 to 100 ratio, what it costs now to launch things into space, even at that rate, it would cost a fortune to get these drills, these tunneling drills, all the way to the moon, back to there.
I'm waiting for the Eastern input to come back. Let me stand by.
I know Eric said he was working on it, so he's probably, maybe he's fooling with it.
Okay. When I let the 8-5 machine thoroughly drop, then the 3-7-5 machine comes back. Looks like we got to do that periodically. It's got that severe requirement. Now, these machines in Switzerland, 1,500 feet long, with a cutting head in the front. Why that long? What's all that extra length doing now, Paul? Go ahead.
Well, it's designed after some kind of worm. I forget the name of the worm. So they, you know, these have been around for, 100 years, but they just keep getting bigger. So this is no different than the one John was talking about, except this one's 1,500 feet long. And what it does is, as it goes through the mountain, the back of it, the end of it expands, and it grabs a hold of the mountain. The front part keeps turning. And then the center of it has all these conveyor belts, as John was saying, and it eventually gets pushed behind it. But that's how big this thing needs to be. And you know, it's got some kind of, this one has some kind of spraying, like spraying like a concrete mix to reinforce the tunnel as it went. You know, this way nothing collapses behind you. All that equipment is needed for this whole process. So I guess by the time you've done it, you find out it's like a quarter of a mile long.
Okay, I let it thoroughly drop. Now, the European Space Agency is in the planning stage of creating a quasi-permanent lunar base. Did they say what their main motivation for doing that is? Is it for geological search, research of what are the rocks made out of and how old are they? Is it a radio telescope installation, studying how much water there's on the moon? Do they state what the major motivation is? Because we're talking about very big bucks here. And what do they get in return? I mean, those individual European nations are going to say, gee, if I give you 10% of my gross national product, what do I get in return? WS2N, K2RIW. I'll wait for a complete drop, Paul, just to be sure.
Well, besides science and plan on one of the goals is to set up radio astronomy antennas on the other, on the dark side of the moon. But that won't help them where they're located. They'll have to, you know, I guess do little jaunts over to wherever the telescope sets up. You know, that's always been a goal. And you can probably do that robotically without people on the dark side of the moon. When I say dark, I mean radio dark. So one of the goals, of course, is to have tourism. That's always a goal. You have some people like Moon Express on a small version plan on launching a spacecraft to the moon within a year or so. They plan on winning the Google Prize, $30 million. So everybody has their own motivation. Win that Google Prize, they have to land on the moon, send HD quality pictures back. Then they have to move to another location 500 meters away, and then they do the same thing, send more HD pictures back, and they'll win $30 million. So that would be their goal. By the way, they have a contract with another company called, it's going to be launched on, they call it the Electron Rocket, and, launched by Rocket Lab. And, it's a real company. And
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Probably by 2017, they'll get their ride on, you know, by Rocket Lab. They set up a launch complex in New Zealand, the North Island. Back to you there.
I'm doing a calculation right now, Paul. If you're setting up a super sensitive radio telescope on the moon, you'd think you'd like it to be on the back side of the moon so it's not listening to Earth radio noise. The two loudest things that disturb a radio telescope are the sun and man-made electronics and the Earth's atmosphere, the ionosphere. Okay. When you're 240,000 miles away from the Earth, I'm going to do a quick calculation as to how many dB of loss you get one way, and I'll bet you it's 180 dB. In other words, all those radio signals from the Earth that you're worrying about through on the other side of the screen room of 180 dB of shielding. Let me drop. So you don't absolutely have to have your radio telescope on the back side of the moon. That little bit of noise you get from the Earth, you can easily filter that because you're such a, you're a quarter of a million miles away from it. So that becomes easier. So you're setting up your optical or radio telescope. Just wait at the right time of the month. The sun is nowhere overhead. And the radio noise from the Earth, I think, is not that bad. So you don't have to go through all the extra degree of difficulty of building a manned lunar base station on the so-called backside of the moon. That's doubled the effort. By having it on the front side of the moon, you have easy communication with the Earth. On the back side of the moon, you need a relay station or something in orbit. And that's a lot of extra rigmarole. So I'll bet you when they do a back-of-the-envelope calculation, Paul, they're going to find out that the front side of the moon for a radio telescope and an optical telescope, I think it's good enough. Over to you, Paul. Wait for a complete drop, K2LIW.
And no atmospherics to deal with either, Dick.
Okay, very good. I think I left it drop long enough. Probably double the John, I think. Yeah, okay. Well, these are all long-term goals. I'm probably thinking 20 years out. But in the meantime, I just wanted to... as you were talking, I went over to the Weinmark TechNet website, and Mike did very good. I see what he did. I was wondering how he was going to get that in there. Very, very cool. Mike K1MJM. He's got that whole report in there. It's a lot longer than the last one. All kinds of pictures and Back over to you, Dick. This is WS2N.
One of the lower frequencies. I'm waiting for the Eastern repeater to come back. It just came back. One of the lowest frequencies you're likely to do serious radio astronomy is 10 gigahertz. And at 10 gigahertz, I was involved in that mission at Edwards Air Force Base out in California, where they spent $63 million building a shielded room, state-of-the-art shielded room, that has 100 decibels of attenuation. It shields you that much from the outside world. And it's big enough to put a whole B-1B bomber in there. The free space loss at 10 gigs for the lunar distance, 240,000 miles, is not 100 dB, it's 164 dB at 10 gigs. As you go up the frequency, the number goes higher yet. So as I see it, a radio telescope and an optical telescope on the front side of the moon is good enough. 164 dB one way. That's a lot of shielding. You try to do that with a screen room. You'd have to build two screen rooms inside of each other. 63 megabucks for each one of them, if you know what I mean. So that distance really helps. We've just solved that problem, Paul. The two base stations just became one. I'm having some fun with you. WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay. I want the moon anyway for a base, because a lot of these, if not all of them nowadays, astronauts and cosmonauts, you know, people from the European Space Agency, you have a whole space station right now, six guys floating around, every one of them has a ham license. Now, could you imagine that on the moon? You know, some guy sitting in there, just like they do down at McMurdo Station in Antarctica, you know, just transmitting away. Get QSL cards from the moon. You couldn't beat that thing. Right there, that's enough motivation to spend all these billions of dollars. Back to you.
What size antenna would these hams have on the moon to reach the Earth at the average ham station down here?
Believe it or not, Barry, and I think you've got very high audio now, you might have to readjust the town on that particular rig inside the house. You may have it set to sideband, if you know what I mean. 240,000 miles sounds like it's a lot of loss. However, you're overcoming that amount of loss when you do a terrestrial communication. So line of sight, although it's a lot of miles, line of sight really makes it easy. A Yagi on each end would do it very nicely, Barry, and 100 watts of power. I'll go through a calculation of that, but I think there's no problem. You're going to have some time delay. Round trip is 2.5 seconds, as you know. You've been through that a zillion times in your earlier life. So when you're listening to an echo off the moon, you're at a huge disadvantage as opposed to an active transmitter on the moon. Very similar to what happens with a synchronous satellite. Let me drop this. That very earliest satellite you put up, Echo 1, which was a 150-foot diameter mylar balloon, and you listen to the echo off of it, and you needed this great big horn and main with a whole lot of kilowatts of power transmitting to it, and the weak little echo you get off that moon, off that 150-foot diameter balloon, gave you a signal over into Europe until the balloon started collapsing. But you put some active electronics on board, pick 100 dB advantage immediately, if you know what I mean. So that's what's going on with the moon. So transmitting one way to the moon with active electronics on the moon, talking back to you, maybe as a repeater, relatively easy. I think it was Dick Turin, W2IMU, did propose at one time that if there was enough Apollo launches left, we should put a 2 meter or a 450 or a 10 gig repeater on the moon. Back to you for a comment on that, Barry.